Well, I wondered how you would describe Jesus. Well, I've only been back in Sussex for 3 or so months now, and I think I've heard most of those already. I'm sure if you were to go out into Hayward Heath Town Centre with your microphone, you'd probably have some pretty similar responses to those. You know, he's just a good teacher, a moral person on par with Gandhi or someone like that. Someone to be respected, mostly until he says something that you disagree with. He's love, so he doesn't really care how you live, that kind of thing. He's just a good man. Well, what does the Bible say about that question? How does the Bible describe There isn't a question there. That's fine. How does the Bible describe Jesus? That's the question we're thinking about tonight. How does the Bible describe Jesus? Well, have a look down at verse 18 of the passage that we had read for us. Have a look at the end of verse 18. Paul says, "So that in everything he that is Jesus might have the supremacy." Paul says that Jesus is supreme. The word supreme means highest in rank, power, or quality. I don't know what you think about when you hear the word supreme. I guess many of us might think ice cream. For me, actually, it's this man, Kim Jong-il. This is him. He was the supreme leader of North Korea from 1994 to 2011. And I think it's fair to say that he was not a modest chap. His birth was said to have been heralded with a double rainbow and a new star in the heavens. It was widely understood that Kim was divine and that he could control the weather with his moods. Kim said that he spent 3 years at the university in Pyongyang, where he is said to have written 1,500 books. And this is my favourite one. Apparently, he played golf only once. But North Korean media reported that Kim shot a 38 under par round, which included 11 holes in one. The supreme Kim Jong-il, everybody. Now, of course, we rightly laugh at such ridiculous claims because they are patently not true, are they? He is clearly not supremely divine, not least because he's dead and he stayed dead. But not Jesus. Paul tells us that Jesus is supreme. He is absolutely supreme. We've got two headings tonight, and the first is this. Jesus is supreme, firstly, over creation. Supreme over creation, verses 15 to 17. Now, before we jump into these quite wonderful verses, we need to do a little bit of Christian philosophy 101. If you were to boil the Judeo-Christian worldview down into kind of one simple diagram, it would look like this, I think. So you've got God, and you've got everything that is not God. Okay, see if that makes sense. And God creates creation. That's the relationship between. You have God and you have everything else, everything that God makes. God and everything that is not God. Some people call it the creator-creature distinction. Now, with that in mind, listen to the quite extraordinary way in which Paul describes Jesus in relation to creation. Let me read from verse 17. "He that is Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Let's go through the verses. Verse 15, "He is the image of the invisible God. He is God made visible." At Christmas, we often read John 1:18, don't we? "No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known." Jesus makes God visible. All that God is, Jesus is. And as such, verse 15, he is the firstborn over all creation. Now you might be thinking, ha-ha, firstborn, doesn't that make him a creature? You know, first among created beings. Well, we'll see in the later verses in a moment that that can't be the case. But even here, I think that would be to misunderstand the phrase. The idea of the firstborn son has to do with being an heir. So the firstborn son is the one with the superior rank under the father. And the firstborn had the special place in the father's heart. And so it is here. Verse 15, Jesus is the firstborn. He is supreme over creation. But there's no wiggle room. There can't be, because verse 16, for by him all things were created. That is, everything that is not God, do you see? Things in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things, it's emphatic, all things have been created by him. All things, everything you can see, everything you can't see, every category you have within creation, everything that is not God, Jesus made. It's worth just kind of stopping and chewing on that, isn't it, for a moment? Think about the oceans. Think of the stars. Think of the mountains. Think of the subatomic particles. Think of all the things that we enjoy. And here's where it literally gets close to the bone for us. He's made all things. And that means that he's made us. Here's an extraordinary question to think about. Who owns you? Who owns you? In our Western culture, we're all our own creators now, aren't we? That's the kind of language we use, such that we can fashion ourselves and refashion ourselves into anything we want to be. We can do what we want to do because I own me. You know, this is mine. To do with what I want, thank you very much. I can say who I am, and nobody can tell me otherwise. And so the logical outworking of that eventually was always going to mean that we could say things like, I was a man, but now I'm a woman. Do you see how that follows logically? We literally recreate ourselves, our culture does. But it follows, doesn't it? Because I own me. I'm my own creator. I say who I am. But no, says Paul. All things were created by him. And because he is God, they were created for his glory alone. End of verse 18. All things were created by him and for him. For his glory, for his honour, for his praise. That is why all things, that is why creation exists. It exists for Jesus. We get the idea generally, don't we, that if you make something, you own it and you decide what it is. Well, so here, all things were created by him and for Jesus. And as such, he is supreme over creation. And he still is, verse 17. He is before all things. That is, he is the creator God, not a created being. And in him, currently, present tense, all things hold together. That is, he sustains all things now. I used to love watching David Attenborough's nature documentaries, you know, Planet Earth and that kind of thing. I think there's a new one out soon. You know, the kind of thing where they spend months and months and months in the middle of nowhere filming and editing and putting together this visually beautiful documentary. And you find yourself thinking, how on earth did they film that? But I'm almost at the point now where I can't watch them anymore because I find myself getting so frustrated with David Attenborough. So you know the kind of scene, you've got this deeply impressive mother polar bear and they've camped out for months and months to get this one shot of her giving birth. And just at the moment that the pup drops out, the sun comes up, bursts through the clouds and illuminates this wonderful, wonderful mountain scenery, the lakes glistening, and it's just wonderful. And David Attenborough says something like, ah, isn't Mother Nature glorious? And you're there chucking stuff at the telly. No! All things were created by him and for him. And in him, all things hold together. You can't. He is supreme. He is supreme over creation. It was made by him. It is sustained by him for his glory. Jesus is supreme over creation. I wonder where that sits with your current worldview this evening. So if you think all religions are basically the same and equally valid as some of the guys in the video did, Paul says that you're wrong. You must be wrong. Jesus, the beloved Son of God the Father, alone is supreme over creation. By him and for him all things were made. He doesn't share his glory outside of the Godhead. He is supreme. Maybe in your worldview there is no God, or at least not a God who is knowable. But Paul says you're wrong, because all things were made by him and for him. And that is a knowable him. A him who walked onto the pages of human history, who said things that only a creator God could say and did things that only a creator God could do. You see, you'd expect if the creator, the Son of God, showed up on earth taking on a human nature, you'd expect him to be able to, for example, control creation, wouldn't you? In fact, you'd ask him to prove that he was the creator by doing that. People often think that, you know, miracles are a problem for Christians. Not at all, because actually people would expect them. And so when Jesus walked out onto the deck of a boat during a furious storm and just said, shh, as we sung, the storm vanished immediately. And no wonder the witnesses said, Mark 4:41, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. They got something of the glory of the Son that day. No wonder they were amazed and terrified. But it makes perfect sense, because Jesus is supreme over creation. But Paul doesn't stop there, does he? Paul wants the Colossians to know that Jesus is supreme, not just in the creating of creation, but in its restoration. Verses 18 to 20. Let me read from verse 18 again. He, that is Jesus, is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Going back to Kim Jong-il's North Korea, it really was not fun to be around him. That probably goes without saying. Those who offended him in any way were either killed immediately or just sent off to Nazi-style concentration camps. You see, the idea was that if you offended the supreme leader, even if you'd done nothing wrong, you were just kind of gratuitously punished. It was immediate, it was swift. Well, is that the case for Jesus, the supreme leader, if you like? Well, it's true to say, isn't it, that none of us have lived consistently as if verses 15 to 17 were true. In fact, haven't we lived as if we're in charge? You know, I'll live how I want, thank you very much. I don't want to be told how I should live my life. I don't want to be told who I am. That's where we are, kind of status is by nature, isn't it? And so how would you expect a good, just, holy, loving God to act? Well, you'd expect him to be just, wouldn't you? For example, you'd want him to hold Kim Jong-il accountable for all that he's done. But of course, that means that we have a problem too, doesn't it? It means that because we have rejected the Son, God is rightly angry with us. And that is right, isn't it, when you think about who he is? We were made by him and for him. Who are we to reject him? And so, if you just look at one verse on from the end of our passage, verse 21, we are by nature alienated from God. We are God's enemies. That is our natural status. But Paul says that Jesus isn't just supreme, over creation. He is supreme, in some sense, over its restoration. Verse 20, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. You see, he doesn't just punish instantly, does he? There is the offer of forgiveness as part of this reconciliation of all things. Now, I've often found this verse a bit of a puzzle, because it just doesn't read quite how you'd expect it to read. What you'd expect Paul to say, verse 20, is something like, and through him to reconcile the church by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. But he doesn't say that, does he? Somehow, Christ's work is about reconciling all things to himself. So what on earth does Paul mean by all things? As ever, an illustration might well help us here. Get your imaginations going. Imagine a great kingdom with a great king. Think kind of Lord of the Rings, that kind of thing. A great kingdom with a great king. And this king is responsible for everything that is good about the kingdom. He started the kingdom, he's grown the kingdom, and everything wonderful about the kingdom is because of him. It is a wonderful place to be. But imagine that one day the king's subjects inexplicably turn him and throw him out of the kingdom. So now they live how they want, and the city goes to the proverbial pan. Selfishness and greed become normal. People are enslaved and abused, and infighting and murder become commonplace. The kingdom is a mess. Well, imagine that many years later, the king returns with an enormous army to take back the city. His power means that there is absolutely no hope of the city standing. The king has come to bring restoration, right order, back to his city. All things in the kingdom are to be reconciled to right order again. Right order is going to be restored under the king. But instead of just obliterating the city, imagine that the king sends his people a message, warning them about what is about to happen. And amazingly, imagine that he offers a complete pardon to all those who will come out of the city and join him. It would make for some film, wouldn't it? Well, I think that is the sense of verses 18 to 20. Jesus is the king of the creation, of the kingdom. All things were made by him and for him, and yet we have rejected him. And so the world and everything in it is broken. Selfishness and greed have become normal. People are enslaved and abused. Infighting and murder are commonplace amongst the human race, aren't they? And as we've already seen, God is rightly angry about that. How dare we reject his son, the king? And so the Father sends God the Son to bring peace, right order to his world, to his kingdom. Verse 19, it starts with Jesus being born in that sense. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. God the Son came into the world. He really did. He came, verse 18, to save the church. That is, those who trust in Jesus, those who turn from rebellion to love and submit to King Jesus. And how does he save them from God's wrath? We'll end of verse 20. By dying. Through his blood being shed on a Roman cross, he takes the punishment in our place. What happens then? Well, middle of verse 18. 3 days later, he rose from the dead, such that he's the supreme one, the firstborn from among the dead, among those who are part of this restored creation. Why? End of verse 18. So then in everything, he might have the supremacy. It's a restoration. So to go back to our illustration, Jesus is the king. He's come into his creation and he has reasserted his supremacy supremely through his death. You read Mark chapter 15, where Mark records the crucifixion. And the point is clear. This is the enthronement of the king, the Son of God. It is through his death, that peace, that right order can be restored in his creation again. The message can now go out to all those who will turn from rebelling against the Son and will be pardoned. It can go out. And all those who persist in rebelling against the King and his message of pardon will be defeated and punished. It's inevitable. In that sense, I think, Christ has reconciled all things to himself, in that peace and right order has been, is being, and will be restored in creation, under its head, the Lord Jesus. But it doesn't feel like that, you say. Well, this peace, this right order in creation, which Christ has brought, is either freely accepted or forcibly imposed. And as such, it is a now but not yet thing, I think. Now it is freely accepted by those who will stop rebelling against the Son. And when he returns, when he gets to the city gates, if you like, for those who have continued to rebel against Jesus, this peace will be forcibly imposed. Hell is a place of punishment and, in some sense, imprisonment, so that those who persist in rejecting him as he delays his judgment will not be able to ruin the new creation that he will bring in. Perfect peace in creation, restored. I know that second point's a lot, but do you get the big idea? Jesus is supreme. He is supreme in creation, and he is supreme in its restoration, so that in all things he might have this supremacy. But as we think about drawing all this together this evening, we need to ask a question. Why does Paul write this here? That's always a good question to ask, isn't it? If you read the commentators on these verses, some of them think that Paul has borrowed an old hymn, an ancient hymn about Jesus that was known in the early church, and he's just going to drop this in because it's nice to talk about Jesus. But it's a bit of a tangent to the rest of the letter. I want to argue that absolutely misses the point of what Paul's saying here, because I think it is absolutely foundational to the letter. Many of you will be familiar with Paul's letter to the Colossians, but just by way of reminder, Paul is writing to this young church in Colossae, and these early Christians were being tempted to add to Jesus, to think that the gospel was not enough, that they needed to add to the work of Jesus. So, for example, chapter 2, verse 16, if you just look over. These early Christians were hearing things like, you're not really sorted if you don't follow these particular Jewish rules. They were hearing that they were missing out, later on in the verses, on true spirituality. Because they hadn't had these visions, these experiences. End of chapter 2, they were hearing that they weren't going to really grow as Christians unless they treated their bodies harshly by having all these new sets of rules, trying to change the heart. The heart of each attack, Jesus isn't enough. Jesus isn't enough. He is not sufficient. You need to top him up. And so Paul says, in effect, that is baloney, because Jesus is supreme, and so he's sufficient. Why would you go and worship anyone else? Anything else to hedge your bets? Jesus is supreme. All things were made by him and for him. And so he's sufficient. You don't need to worship anything else because he is supreme. Why would you need to go to religion, to the rules of religion to save you? He is supreme. He saves completely. What he says goes in his creation. He saves completely. He is enough. He is sufficient for your salvation. His life, his death, his resurrection, his work of salvation is sufficient because he is supreme, etc., etc., etc. False teaching always has, and it always will, seek to undermine or try to subvert the supremacy and therefore the sufficiency of Jesus. That's been the story of 2,000 years of heresy. Trying to do that, undermine the supremacy and therefore the sufficiency of Jesus. Paul says, don't listen. He is the image of the invisible God. He is the one through whom and for whom all things were made. And he who is the one who brings and will bring the perfect peace of God on earth. He has no rival. He is supreme. And so he's sufficient. As we close this evening, what are the applications for us? Well, if you're not yet a Christian here tonight, then the application is very obvious and very simple. Stop rebelling against creation's king. Turn from your rebellion now, before it is too late, before he gets to the city gate, and ask him to pardon you. The offer is there. It is a genuine offer. Don't continue in the madness like the rest of the world. Don't continue in the madness of living in Jesus' world without reference to him and thinking it will be okay. It won't. Christ went to the cross to spare his people the wrath of God. Don't think for a moment he would have done that unless he had to. He will come again to judge. And at that point, it will be merciless. Please, please stop rebelling against him. And this evening, ask him to forgive you. He will. But that offer has a very fixed expiry date. And if you are a Christian here this evening, then two related things quickly for us. The first is obvious, but I'm going to say it. Adore him. He is your maker. He is your saviour. If the Jesus in your mind is anything other than the maker and sustainer of all things, then refocus the lens of your heart this evening so that you see him, so that you behold him clearly in his glory, in his beauty, in his supremacy. There will be all sorts of things going on in each of our lives, joys, sorrows, struggles that others know about, struggles that others don't. But the way in which we view Christ changes the way we think about our circumstances, doesn't it? There are very few, if any, situations that aren't helped by us knowing that Jesus is supreme. So take anxiety, for example. Why would you possibly need to get anxious? He is supreme. He is the one who loves you and who died for you. He is the one who is in complete, underline, italics, complete control. Nothing happens without his express permission. Nothing happens that he does not use to make us more like him. He is supreme. And that needs to permeate into every area of our lives. Maybe this week, if there's an area that you're particularly struggling with, just let that idea marinate in your mind. Jesus is supreme. How does that change this particular situation? How does that change the way I think about that? Adore him. Adore him in your heart this evening. And secondly, rejoice in and rest in his sufficiency. I don't know how you find yourself doubting it this evening, but our perennial problem as Christians is doubting that Jesus is enough, that he has saved us enough, that he has done all that is needed, etc., etc., etc. No, he is supreme, and so he is sufficient. For those of you who like equations, here's an equation for you. Jesus plus nothing equals everything. Jesus plus nothing equals everything. Jesus is supreme, and so he is sufficient. And so the only smart thing to do is to trust and to keep trusting in this Christ.